It's pledge season on Slate Podcasts. If you love the Slate Culture Gabfest, you can help support it by joining Slate Plus at slate.com/culture plus. We'll be talking about it more later in the show.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Stephen McCaffin. This is the Slate Culture Gabfest Too Good to Last edition. It's Wednesday, October 4th, 2017. On today's show, Battle of the Sexes is the new movie that tells the story of the tennis match pitting hustler and male chauvinist pig Bobby Riggs against Billie Jean King, then a dominant women's player and one of the greatest women's player of all time. And then it is a horrible injustice to speak of Tom Petty in the past tense. He, of course, died this week. He was a rock and roll legend. I cannot do him justice. We will try. He was a songwriter, performer, band leader of the First Order, on and on. We will be joined by Chris Malamphy to discuss an extraordinary career and equally extraordinary legacy. And finally, we are living in what's been called the great age of nonfiction. And the greatest nonfiction writer of them all, I think almost without controversy, is John McPhee. He's certainly up there with Joan Didion and Janet Malcolm. We discuss a profile of McPhee in the New York Times Magazine with its author, Sam Anderson. Joining me today is Slate's editor, Julia Turner. Hello, Julia.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for holding down the fort last week when I was ill. I'm grateful.
You were truly missed.
And, of course, Slate's film critic, Dana Stevens. Hey, Dana.
Hey, Stephen.
All right, well, digging right in, the 1973 tennis match known as the Battle of the Sexes was more of a canned media event than a competitive sporting match, at least going in. Bobby Riggs was an over-the-hill ex-champion who loved the hustle. He loved to gamble, and he thrived in the limelight. When he challenged a then-29-year-old Billie Jean King to a tennis match, it was more for the attention and the laughs. But the male chauvinists loved it, and by the time the two actually played to a sold-out Astrodome crowd of about 50,000 and a TV audience estimated at 90 million, a lot was riding on the outcome. This movie stars Emma Stone as King and Steve Carell as Bobby Riggs. Let's listen to a clip.
It's Bobby Riggs.
Bobby? How'd you get my number?
Called every hotel in San Diego. Listen, I had a great idea.
Okay. Well, it's after midnight, Bobby, so can we talk another time?
You and me, Billie Jean. 3 sets, 5 sets, your choice.
Are you drunk, Bobby?
No, of course not. How about this? Man versus woman. Male chauvinist pig versus hairy-legged feminist. No offense. You're still a feminist, right?
No, I'm a tennis player who happens to be a woman.
That's right. That's exactly who you are. And I am a tennis player who happens to be a man.
Says that he can beat any woman on the planet. Think of the publicity that we get. Think of the money.
No.
$35,000.
Where'd you get the kind of money?
You see, you're tempted.
I'm really not. I'm not interested, Bobby. Good night.
Don't hang up.
By the way, I shaved my legs.
All right. Well, Dana, before we dig in, I should say this movie's co-directed by Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris. What'd you think of it?
Well, I think it's worth pointing out before starting the conversation that Jonathan Dayton and Valerie Faris, the co-directors of the movie, who are also a married couple, were the directors of Little Miss Sunshine, which was this, you know, runaway indie darling of 2006, also starring Steve Carell. And I think this movie is a little bit comparable in tone and feeling to Little Miss Sunshine. It's sort of an upbeat feminist, I don't know what you'd call it. I mean, it's not a sports movie, really, per se. The climactic tennis match is sort of unclimactic, the way that it's filmed. We all know how it's going to turn out. And because Emma Stone was playing with a double, it's sort of shot from afar. And I would definitely not call it a sports movie. I feel like it's more of a kind of empowerment anthem movie in the way that Little Miss Sunshine was. And that sounds condescending, but I thoroughly enjoyed this movie. There's nothing that I would change about it, but there's something a little underambitious, maybe, about a movie like this coming out at a moment like this when, you know, for example, yesterday, you know, women are starting to get their reproductive health rights ripped away. And, you know, it's a moment for feminism where we might need an anthem that's a little more hoarsely screamed than this one. But it is thoroughly enjoyable beginning to end. And Steve Carell and Emma Stone are both great, not great in the kind of transforming myself for an Oscar kind of performance, but just a big movie star comic performance. And I really enjoyed it on that scale.
Julia, what'd you make of it?
I thought this movie was kind of bad, but I really enjoyed it, if that makes sense. Like, it's some of the lines in it are super cringeworthy. There's a lot of kind of stock characters. There's a wise gay tennis costume designer, which I didn't know was a cliched position, but he is sort of like the magical gay best friend.
He is based on an actual person.
Yes.
Perhaps less magical.
Yeah, but what's the line he says at the end? Times change. You should know. You just changed them. Like, come on. Come on, guys. Step it up a little. So I, as I think longtime listeners of our show know, I will cry at any sports movie, even one as sort of unsportsy as this sports movie, which you barely see any tennis for like the first 60 minutes. And then you get a little bit of a tennis montage and you get it. The final match gets a satisfying rhythm to it. But you aren't really watching Emma Stone particularly play tennis. But still, I cry at the victory because I'll cry. Any sports triumph, however hokily rendered, will elicit tears for me. But
a dart game in a bar, Julia's on the floor.
Completely. I would 100% watch Darts, the inspirational film. But this, I had like a cathartic and tragic election cry at the end. Like I was having my usual sports movie cry and then I started really crying like, but the women never beat the men and they're not actually equal and everything's fucked up and nothing changed and this was just a show.
This like, is what I mean about maybe needing a hoarse or scream right now. I mean, if Hillary had won, this movie would be a light entertainment that we would all enjoy. But it has, there's some sort of a bitter taste to the end of it because, as you say, it is very sweet and simple and clear cut, the good guys and the bad guys. Though, interestingly, Bobby Riggs is not one of the bad guys. The bad guys really are this this tennis bigwig played by Bill Pullman, who is so sexist that Billie Jean King, and this is a true story, drops out of the Tennis Association to form her own women's tour. And then a female player, Margaret Court, who was the previous female player that Bobby Riggs had beaten very badly. And that was the only reason that Billie Jean took on the match. And she's sort of a bad guy because, as in real life, she was sort of a homophobic and rigidly conservative woman.
Mm-hmm. Right. So, I mean, I think when you make a kind of based on, you know, real life, especially a real life event that had a kind of Super Bowl magnitude toward it, you're doing two things that are hard to balance against one another. One is you're trying to inflate the event for an audience that might not be entirely familiar with it in order to convince them of the importance of it and the picture that you're building around it. At the same time, you're trying to search for a genuinely intimate, convincingly intimate personal story to tell about the participants who often are dwarfed, if not squashed, by the size of it. I mean, I saw this thing live on TV. That's how old I am, and remember it vividly. It turned into a complete circus, which I think they do a good job of conveying. And the match itself was uncompetitive and quite boring and anticlimactic. And as you say, it's not clear exactly what was won, though it's, I think the movie does a good job of reminding you that the Jack Kramer, how acceptable it was for someone like Jack Kramer to voice this, paleo chauvinism openly on television, and that it was great to throw it in his face.
Jack Kramer being the Bill Pullman character I was talking
yes,
about.
The Pullman character, and Pullman's terrific in the film, I think. Emma Stone, I'm very curious what you guys think about the casting. I mean, Carell is sort of, for those of us who remember Bobby Riggs and him appearing a lot on TV in the run-up to this and, you know, cameoing on sitcoms like The Odd Couple, he was very omnipresent to my fourth grade self or whatever it was. Carell is uncannily apt casting. Emma Stone is a little bit unexpected, right, Dana? How do you think she did?
Yeah, well, I mean, I guess probably you mean because she always plays such sweet, girlish characters, right? So to see her playing someone who was sort of famously butch and really a woman who did not fit into the gender standards of her time, then in that sense, yeah, I guess it is sort of unexpected casting. Although it's hard to think of a Hollywood star big enough to attract buyers to a movie this big who would not be more gender standard than Billie Jean King was. Yeah, unusual casting. I think she shows her range and she carries it off. She doesn't quite convince as an athlete. You never quite believe that she's able to, you know, serve a ball hard enough to beat a professional tennis player.
Yeah, she doesn't quite pull off buff.
Right. I mean, she doesn't seem like she's done one of those transformative things of working out for 6 months. But that's okay by me. I feel like that's such a kind of trend in acting now. And why can't we buck it once in a while?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I mean, I guess if I could sit down on paper and recast the movie, I might try to give someone a break who isn't America's sweetheart already. But I can't resist the appeal of Emma Stone. And she's funny. She really gets a lot of comic charge out of the script, which, as Julia pointed out, is not always the strongest script in the world.
Part of why I was so despairing at the end was that the stakes felt so pat and low. And I feel like the lesson of the last year is that the stakes remain high and are higher than we thought. And I don't know. Like, I somehow the Steve Carell of it, I wonder. And if we're doing alternate casting in my mind, I'd actually rather have an alternate Riggs than an alternate.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, God. But
Stone.
I thought Steve Carell was so good as Riggs. And I appreciated that he wasn't the villain. I mean, because in a sense, it is more about systemic sexism than Bobby Riggs is a horrible person who wants to persecute Billie Jean King. And in fact, in life, they became friends after the match. They were not friends before the match, the way the movie seems to imply. But they did remain friendly after for the rest of his life. And the idea that he is a complex person, a gambling addict, a publicity hound, you know, but not somebody who's completely devoid of any moral fiber whatsoever. I don't know. I appreciated that. I think the movie would have been way too black and white and too much of an after school special, morally speaking, if the Bobby Riggs character had been as sexist as Bill Pullman is.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, that's right. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that's right.
What about you, Steve? Did you want to tough up Bobby Riggs a little bit?
No, that would have falsified how this unfolded. Even at the time, it was clear that he was a P.T. Barnum figure more than he was a grotesque, you know, misogynist. And it would have falsified, as you say, Dana, what happened to their relationship afterwards, which is that they became quite close. And in fact, I believe the story is the day before he died, he phoned up Billie Jean King and they told one another that they loved one another. I mean, to me, the most obnoxious thing you can do as a critic is describe the movie you wish you'd seen and thereby hold the one that you did see account to it, which I'm now going to do. I mean, to me, as someone who lived through this and who's thought about it on and off since, it's really the story is of this is really right at the beginning of the modern media spectacle. This is right around when the Super Bowl goes from being just a football game. I mean, it's only 4 years into the Super Bowl or whatever it is, 7 years into the Super Bowl. I mean, and ABC has been, if they haven't been taken over by Rune Arledge yet, they're about to be in Wild World of Sports. ABC starts to learn how to exploit kind of junk or pseudo sports for spectacle power. And to me, the story is really of Billie Jean King, who's a real athlete, a genuine athlete, a monomaniacal competitor, being asked to do something for symbolic value, thinking it is important for the cause of women's rights and women's rights in sports, agreeing to it. And then the monster is unleashed that people are only just familiar with. I mean, 90 million, think about 90 million people back in 1973 watching it. I mean, how many people would have to watch it now comparatively? For it to be that big, I mean, maybe 200 million. I mean, it's I think it's about the modern media spectacle being unleashed on something so that it starts to swallow its participants. And then the irony at the heart of the film is that during this part in her life, she's realizing who she is as a person completely apart from the limelight, which I do think the movie handles sensitively. I mean, I don't know that it handles it deeply, but there is, I think, a real intimacy between Emma Stone and Andrea Riseborough, who plays her hairdresser and lover. And I mean, I'm not saying they didn't make the movie I wanted to see. I just think that that's the heart of the story more than, you know, kind of sexist villainy being vanquished by feminist hero, you know, turning point in the history of women's rights, which in some ways probably wasn't, sadly.
Yeah, I think one of the challenges of what this historical event actually means is tied up in spectacle and symbol and sort of the actual fight for equality in prize money versus like what it means for one particular woman at one particular phase of her career to beat one particular man with one particular set of motives on any particular day, and how that is actually a meaningless event and yet one that took on so much meaning.
Yeah, you know, like Stephen, I was alive for this event, but I was a very small child, and I remember knowing about that. It was impossible not to know about it, right? It was watched by 90 million people. The run-up to it took a whole summer, basically. It happened in September and was publicized the whole summer before. And I remember talking about it on the schoolyard and it becoming this kind of important point of contention between the boys and the girls. And whether you cared anything about sports at all the girls were desperately, desperately rooting for Billie Jean King. And I don't specifically remember the game, but I remember sort of fighting about it on the playground and how important it was to us that she win. And all I could think about watching this movie is that the equivalent event for my daughter's life, and she's a little bit older, was watching Trump beat Hillary and having the exact opposite outcome and just how depressing that is.
All right. Well, on that note, the movie is Battle of the Sexes. I want to say quickly, I really enjoyed it. So mine is a thumbs up. I quibble with it because I liked it very much. Battle of the Sexes, Emma Stone, Steve Carell, check it out. It's open pretty wide. Come and talk to us about it at facebook.com/culturefest. All right, moving on.
Hello. It is the last week of Pledge Week for Slate Plus on Slate Podcasts. If you are still here, that means you've listened to 2 full weeks of Slate Plus Pledge Week segments without signing up for Slate Plus. That means you're really tough to persuade. We're going to take one more shot at persuading you on this week's pledge drive, and then we'll let you back to your normal Slate podcast programming. But just to note, if you had signed up weeks ago for this show that you value, because if you're listening to this and this is resonating, that means you've now heard 3 of these pledge drive segments, you would have an ad-free podcast feed that has Slate Plus bonus segments every week, and you would not be hearing my voice or the voice of Slate Plus editorial director Gabe Roth, who joins us now. Hello, Gabe.
Hi, Julia. That's exactly right. If you're listening to this at home, you could have paid money not to be hearing me right now, but you chose not to do that, and so here I am. You can get rid of me and all of the other ads on this show and get extra bonus editorial content of the Culture Festers discussing the hot topics of the day by signing up at slate.com/cultureplus. Slate.com/cultureplus. So every week, Slate Plus members who are fans of this show, they get to hear the show with no ads, they get to hear the show with no pledge drives, and then they get to hear you guys stick around and talk about another thing. And those other segments, they're where you guys cut loose, you get a little freaky, you get a little wild in a completely PG-13 way. And there was a recent one where you spent about 15 minutes talking about mayonnaise. It was gripping, gripping audio.
And yet slippery.
Gripping and yet oily audio. What else have you guys done recently? Steve, remind me what are some other ones?
Well, I seem to recall especially enlightening and vital segment with Jamelle Bouie about the proposed HBO show Confederate. And it was just classic Jamelle. He walked us through all of the possible interpretations of this proposed hypothetical show, like, you know, all of the permutations of the relevant arguments.
Could he went way beyond kind of hashtag no Confederate, let's wring our hands, right?
Exactly right. I thought it was brilliant to hear that and participate in that conversation.
I feel like sometimes we go spoilery, like when we see a twisty time travel-y movie like Dunkirk. Fact check, there's no time travel in Dunkirk. It just has a complicated chronological structure, but in any event.
And then also sometimes it's just we get a little goofy in a way that is, I think, sometimes illuminating.
Like, once you start listening to the Slate Plus 4th segment of a show that you like, which I do now for the Slate Political Gabfest every week, it just becomes like part of the show. I would consider the show incomplete if I didn't have that 4th plus segment. So it really does kind of become organic to your listening experience.
This is just generally how life is if you don't belong to Slate Plus. You're experiencing life at like 75% fidelity. Like, you just aren't quite getting...
There's a spectrum of color that's not visible to you.
All right. Thank you, guys. If you enjoy this show more than all other Slate shows, be sure to sign up for Slate Plus via the URL slate.com/cultureplus. The Culture Gabfest wants to win the contest for the most Slate Plus signups during this pledge drive. Slate Plus membership costs $35 for your first year. If that's something you can afford to help support the show you love and to get more of it, please do. Slate.com/cultureplus. Thanks, guys. Back to you.
All right. Well, this next segment is recorded with a heavy heart, but also with joy in it for the gift this man had and gave to the world. Tom Petty came out of Gainesville, Florida with a homegrown twang and a mostly homegrown and, in my estimation, perfect backing band. He had a knifing voice, a lot of anger, and a way with a monster hook. He was a romantic in substance, but a classicist in style, and everything he did was tight, tight, tight. Don't bore us, get to the chorus was the band's unofficial motto, and he made a superb debut album in the mid-70s, featuring one of the greatest rock and roll songs ever written. I mean, can you imagine American Girl being on your first fucking album? However, his third record in 1979 was, in my estimation, it is actually a perfect rock and roll record. Damn the Torpedoes kicks off with Refugee, and Tom Petty was a FM rock and roll radio staple ever since. There's so much concision in his songwriting, taught in execution. The man made radio format hits, album format classic rock records. There are so many different songs to listen to, but why don't we start with American Girl? All right, well, to discuss the huge legacy of Tom Petty, we're joined by Slate's own Chris Malampe. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Steve.
Let's try to convey to people, I mean, he's familiar almost to everybody, but maybe not everybody understands that he was great. He was so kind of taken for granted. There's something
I agree
archetypal about his sound that masks its originality, or at least its singularity. It seems to me he's one of those very, very few people whose claim as a pop star is equal to his claim on being a rock and roll star.
Yeah, you know, he wasn't just an instant classic rocker, although he very quickly became that. He really crossed a lot of pop currents right from the beginning of his career. One of the details I sort of knew but uncovered more specifically as I did my research is that he and the Heartbreakers broke in 1977 in England before they broke in America. They actually had chart hits in England before they had a single chart hit in America. Believe it or not, American Girl never made the Billboard Hot 100, yet it made the bottom rungs of the top 40 in England, crazily enough, despite its title. Petty was, he's happily remembered by folks who remember that punk and post-punk period as having what Squeeze's Glenn Tilbrook called punk energy. And he, you know, he used to joke that in the late 70s, they were marketing him as new wave and dressing he and the band in skinny ties, even though that, you know, wasn't exactly what they were. But, you know, he surfed new wave. He surfed MTV. He surfed grunge in the 90s. He was still scoring hits deep into the, you know, Nirvana and Pearl Jam era. The guy's ability to, you know, surf multiple waves and kind of look like he was on his own plane was really stunning.
Yeah, I mean, Chris, I pick out. There's southern rock, there's punk, there's new wave. He was old enough to be influenced by Elvis, young enough to be equally blown away by seeing the Beatles on Ed Sullivan. There's obviously Dylan in the voice and a lot of the songwriting. The Birds are big in The Waiting, especially. You do not find that blend, and yet he's imitating nobody but himself.
I'm struck. I mean, this analysis of the unusual arc of his career and the various currents he floated on, I think, illuminates for me part of why this death hit me so hard. I mean, we've obviously lost so many hugely significant musical talents in the last 2 years. And I think probably if you were to make the argument, although I don't know why you would necessarily, that Bowie and Prince were more significant, more transformative, broke more ground in terms of identity and politics. And, you know, like, I would stipulate if anybody wanted to that those were kind of more significant artists. Somehow losing Tom Petty stabs me in the core in a way that those particular artists didn't meet, just because of the personal relationship I have with his work. And I think that a lot of people of my sort of between X and Y generation have that relationship to him. And thinking about it, it made me realize he was sort of the last practicing rock star of that shifting to hip hop and grunge era. I mean, I suppose you could say Kurt Cobain is a rock star if you wanted to, but he felt like he was coming out of kind of 70s classic rock. What in my head as a kid in the 80s rock was, he seemed like that. like a rock star the grown-ups would recognize as a rock star. And yet I grew up with his songs. They were steeped in my brain. Like, he was sort of the last rock star, the rock star of my mind. And I took the music for granted, and, you know, the songs on Full Moon Fever, maybe minus Zombie Zoo. But, like, you know, the songs from the Greatest Hits album, the songs from Full Moon Fever were all completely etched in my mind. And I think I only grew over time to appreciate a couple things that make them more than just being the archetype of rock that I held in my head next to, you know, sort of Nirvana and Superchunk on the alt indie side, and kind of the rise of hip hop and R&B on the pop radio. And those, the two things that I hear now are, and that I'd be curious to hear you speak to, Chris, are one, his approach to production. Why do his songs sound so good? They sound so clear. It sounds like there's so much space in them. I do not necessarily have the vocabulary for this, but they remind me of the way Paul Simon songs sound, actually, like just the precision of the authorship.
Yeah.
To me, it's part of what's intense. Enduring about them. Like, it's incredibly honed. And then the storytelling and language is so potent. Like, the songs are spare. They feel like they could have been, you know, sung in dirty bars for 5 decades. And yet, if you really listen to the lyrics, they're extraordinary. And, you know, our colleague and friend of the program, Gabriel Roth, wrote a piece saying Tom Petty was perhaps rock's greatest writer of first lines. And I think you could argue that a lot of the lines of his songs are great, but I'll just cite the few that Gabe mentions here, because I think he's really onto something. Well, she was an American girl raised on promises. Refugee. We got something. We both know it. We don't talk too much about it. Rebels. Honey, don't walk out. I'm too drunk to follow. Down south. Headed back down south. Gonna see my daddy's mistress. Headed back down south. Letting you go. I used to think that when this was all over, you might feel different about me. I used to think that when this was all over, you might feel different about me. Yeah, they're just they're like little O. Henry stories. I mean, they're not even that. The storytelling is so compact and so potent. And I'm just gonna miss him.
I mean, I think Damn the Torpedoes is the perfect rock and roll record, and it's a sonically perfect record because they brought in Jimmy Iovine, and this was, Chris, you'll know much more about this than me, but this was a big turning point in his career, because he had been the engineer on Springsteen's records, but was transitioning at that point in his career to being the honcho, the producer. Why don't we listen to the second cut on that record, Here Comes My Girl, and that'll give you all of what Julia was just talking about. I mean, the ability of that guy to go big without lapsing into bombast or fake sublimity, I mean, it's just a remarkable maker of records.
I have a question about the Springsteen comparison. There was a piece in The New Yorker, not an obit, in which Nicholas Davidoff calls him the Southern Springsteen. And and I wanted to know, as, you know, Springsteen listeners, what you thought of that comparison and how the South comes into his music and what's different about it in that way.
Springsteen, Petty, and Prince are all people who came of recording age, if you will, in the second half of the 1970s at a moment when the rock canon was starting to harden and calcify. And so, unlike, say, a Dylan or, I don't know, a John Lennon, they have already sort of ingested 2 decades worth of rock history. And they are now trying to figure out how to reconstitute it and reinvent it in their own image. And much of their output postdates punk. It postdates, you know, tectonic shifts in what rock and roll meant. And so when I think of a comment like Petty as the Southern Springsteen, I'm thinking of a guy who is, like Prince, steeped in decades of an already existent rock canon and is creating something new out of it. And I think this is what Steve was getting at a little while ago about how he wore his influences, but he wore them lightly, and then he turned it into something his own. He was of his time. He wasn't a classicist, which I think is part of why we're all so devoted to him, because when he was scoring hits in the late 70s, the early 80s, the late 80s, the mid 90s, again, at the peak of grunge, he never sounded like he was, you know, on a nostalgia trip. He always mm-hmm. sounded like he had found a way to, with the economy of his songwriting, to, you know, reconstitute rock history into something utterly current, utterly mm-hmm. of its time, right. of its moment.
On the comparison of Springsteen, I would say they're superficial. Like, they come of age at the same time, as Chris Wrightley says. They're both white guys with a guitar doing something that has a heartland resonance to it. Otherwise, I think they are completely different artists. I mean, I say this as someone whose love of Bruce Springsteen is literally second to none, second to nobody's in the whole world. And yet,
that's stiff competition.
That's a challenge.
I would watch that Hunger Games.
And yet, I absolutely think Springsteen is for people who love Springsteen and for nobody else. I mean, he is not for everybody. Is there a person in the world for whom there isn't at least one Tom Petty song that when it comes on the radio, they fucking crank it? I mean, I just think Tom Petty has a universality that Springsteen couldn't ever have. And Springsteen, in part, he bears the burden of wanting to be sublime almost every time out and kind of burst the bounds of, you know, the possibility of the narrow form with so much energy and such a huge vision of what both rock and roll and America are. And when it misfires, it's completely off. And when it hits, it does achieve a kind of sublimity. And the stakes are just completely different for Tom Petty. You know, as Julia says, it's like, you know, two cars sparkle on the overpass, rocks hit the water like a broken glass. You know, I mean, it's like these little glimmers, these little slivers. It's not, he never bore the burden of channeling all of the unconscious of the continental United States.
And, right, less and, ponderous, and the right?
Rock and roll.
You can hear that.
He just has this sidelong quality in those, even in his own music videos. He's often kind of leaning and creeping at the edge of the frame. He's so skinny. He has that kind of like thinness of his skin on his face. He almost looks like a skeleton. Like he just has this spectral quality that makes it seem like he's observing everything through this narrow, beautiful, precise lens rather than trying to embody something quite so big. And that's, I think, what makes his song so sneakily powerful.
And he's amused and bemused by his own fame. I mean, I see exactly the same quality you see in his videos, Julia. You know, as I was thinking about his career overnight, to me, one of the interesting pivot points in his career, to dovetail with what Julia was talking about, is that late 80s moment. That really could have been the moment. Petty was nearing 40. He could have sort of eased into an early dotage. Don't forget, he was one of the Traveling Wilburys who recorded that, you know, supergroup album in 1988, George Harrison, Jeff Lynne, Bob Dylan, and Roy Orbison. And he was the youngest member of the Traveling Wilburys. And that was kind of like his ticket getting stamped by his elder statesman. The year before, he had toured with Bob Dylan and the Heartbreakers. Dylan had helped co-write one of his hits. It looked like one of those moments where, you know, Petty was going to ease into middle age and hang back and become, you know, some kind of boomer nostalgia icon. And then he drops Full Moon Fever, which is his biggest album. It's a quintuple platinum album. It went like six or seven singles deep. It still gets played on the radio today. He was riding the charts alongside the likes of, I don't know, Michael Bolton and Jody Watley and, you know, late 80s pop stars. I literally looked this up, like the stuff that was sitting in the top 10 the week that Free Fallin' peaked in the top 10. And it's like Skid Row. And, you know, it's the idea that Tom Petty was scoring hits on just shy of his 40th birthday and the biggest hits of his career. I mean, again, his relevance for multiple decades is just remarkable. And like you say, in the videos and throughout his career, he wore his fame lightly, and I think that translated.
I'd be remiss if right at the end of the segment I didn't say he did have probably the best backing band in the business. He said it himself, two of the greatest musicians just walked into his life. Ben Montench on keyboards and Mike Campbell on guitar. Those two guys just, you know, I mean, all that band was great, but those two guys really made it. Tom Petty was lost way too young. Chris Malamphy, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about his legacy.
It was my pleasure, Steve. Thanks.
Before our final topic, I want to jump in with a bit of business. On Slate Plus today, we'll be talking about Twitter's new feature enabling 280 characters per tweet. Is it a force for good? Will it ruin the platform? Is the platform ruined already? And what do we think of tweet storms? These and other subjects will be discussed in our Slate Plus segment, available only to Slate Plus members. Also, Hit Parade is back. This time, Chris Malanfi examines the war against the retail single and how it ultimately helped lead to the implosion of the music business in the early 2000s. As always, his Hit Parade episodes are available on our Culture Gabfest feed, but we are thrilled to announce that he is now launched a fully hatched hatchling, a fully fledged fledgling into his own feed. Search for Hit Parade wherever you get your podcasts and you will get all of the requisite notifications for every new episode as it drops.
Oh, Julia, before we go out of business, let me interject the lecture that I gave at Ohio State on Robert Frost and neoliberalism and the American tradition or some such mishmash is now available, and we are on the web and we're posting the link on our show page.
Cool. That's great. All right. Onward.
John McPhee is a writing professor at Princeton University. This is the whopping understatement of the century. He's arguably also the greatest nonfiction writer of all time, certainly one of them, virtually the inventor of what's sometimes called creative nonfiction, author of books such as Sense of Where You Are, Curve of Binding Energy, Coming into the Country, as well as a teacher who's sent more original nonfiction talents into the world than probably anybody. There's a new profile of the great John McPhee called The Mind of John McPhee by one of our favorite nonfiction artists, Sam Anderson, great friend of the program at GFOP. Sam, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Sam, quickly, for listeners of ours who may not, for whatever reason, be totally familiar with the work of John McPhee, and rather than listing classics, describe what's distinctive about his approach to nonfiction.
McPhee's career started really in the 60s at the same time that a lot of other great nonfiction writers were getting out there, the sort of new journalism movement with Tom Wolfe and Joan Didion and people like that. What sets McPhee apart is he's a little more recessive than those people. He's a little less obviously kind of sexy in style than either of those writers I just named. And I would say his curiosity is more ambitious than theirs. He kind of just flows around the world looking at everything there is to look at. He's very interested in science and ecology. And, you know, he wrote this book, Coming into the Country, which is this enormous kind of masterwork about Alaska, the great wilderness that was being kind of chipped into by civilization. And went and lived there forever. And there's this great set piece in that book, which I think is a nice illustration of his style, where he was in this little town living in a kind of shack out in the middle of the snowy woods. I think it was called Eagle, Alaska. And he just spent one entire day at the post office, which was kind of the hub of this place in the middle of the wilderness. And he recorded just every conversation that was going on in the Eagle, Alaska post office. And you just got such a sense of this strange collection of people and their strange rituals of like waiting for the little tiny prop plane to come in and bring them things from civilization. And I don't know, he's just been able to put himself in situation after situation like that for going on, 50 years now.
He's also just one of the invisible geniuses, which is why it's so pleasing that he would have written a book about craft and that then mm-hmm. a craftsman like yourself would dissect it for the rest of us. Increasingly, I find myself classifying writers as either the people who want to show you what their words can do or the people who want to show you the world. and he's definitely the patron saint of the latter camp, like clean, lucid, spare, understated. Mm-hmm. Like it's entirely about the meaning he's conjuring rather than the fireworks of the display. And I'm not saying that the other isn't fun. I mean, I love pyrotechnic writing too, and sometimes pyrotechnic writing can convey meaning in different ways than the kind of spare and lucid kind, but his craft is so fine you can hardly see it, and that's what makes it intriguing to begin to be able to look at it, and that he's interested in looking at it at this particular moment. I was struck in your piece by the fact that he's never been profiled, that he's never, yeah, I mean, he's notoriously shy, but that he actually hasn't really, he's successfully evaded everybody's gaze for so long.
I did get a tweet from a writer who said he profiled John McPhee in 1982.
okay.
But since then,
seldom.
As far as I know, he has not truly been profiled like this. Yeah, it was amazing to talk to the people in his life and the writers he's influenced and former students and admirers, and just to listen to them gush about what an influence he's been. And then all of them at one point or another said, I can't believe he agreed to do this. And I said, why do you think he agreed to be profiled? And they said, I can't possibly imagine. So finally, kind of toward the end of things, I asked John, I said, I don't normally get this meta in an interview with a profile subject, but why did you agree to this? And he said, oh, the publisher asked me to do it. That was it. There were a bunch of great moments like that where I kind of teed him up for some vast existential philosophizing, and he was just like so matter of fact. It was hilarious.
Sam, if I'm not mistaken, GPS is a very special character in this piece, though maybe not in the most obvious way. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that's true. The piece starts with John McPhee trying to give me driving directions. And he is, by all accounts, a master of giving people driving directions. Ian Fraser at The New Yorker was telling me, had several stories about driving with John McPhee. And I found myself after a while just kind of, to his disappointment, saying, sorry, John, but I'm probably just going to type your address into my phone and then follow that, which is what I ended up doing. But I use that as a framing device for the piece because I think one of the things that's so interesting about his mind and his engagement of the with the world and with writing is that it's such a question of mapping, of structures, of truly understanding the places you are in, how they're arranged, how you relate to them, how to get around them. He grew up going to this wilderness camp in Vermont, I think it was, called Key Waden, and became a real outdoorsy kid there. And I think there's something there about engaging firsthand in a very practical way with the landscape and learning how to navigate it. So that's why I started with that.
Well, it also just provides a very funny contrast, a comic contrast between your way of wayfinding in the world and his, that points up what an unusual kind of brain he has. I had questions about structure, Sam, because I happened to be reading, before we decided to have you as a guest and before this profile came out, I'm reading draft number 4, his new book about nonfiction writing. And I had pre-ordered it when I first heard about it because, come on, John McPhee, he's a legendary writer and writing teacher, and I wanted him to tell me how to write my nonfiction book, right? Then I cracked draft number 4, and I get to sentences like this, which I would have talked about even if you didn't quote this in your profile. Let me read it. And he's describing the process of figuring out the structure of Encounters with the Archdruid, his book from 1971. He says, I began to think of a sequence of 6 profiles in which a 7th party would appear in a minor way in the first, appear again in greater dimension in the second, grow further in the third, further in the fourth, fifth, and sixth, always in subordinate ratio to the principal figure in each piece until becoming the central figure in the 7th and final profile. However, I backed away from this chimerical construction. And that's only the tip of the iceberg of the insanity of his process as detailed in this book. So although I'm greatly enjoying the book, I'm still in the middle of it, I feel like it's going to teach me about as much practical day-to-day advice about nonfiction writing as I could learn how to photosynthesize light and water into chlorophyll or whatever that process is. He's a different being entirely. So I want to hear what you have to say about that. I mean, as a reader of this book and as having met him and read so many of his books, like what is this insane obsession with structure? And yet how does it somehow magically transform into, as Julia says, very modest and non-pyrotechnic writing?
Yeah, I think you've put your finger on what is unique about him and about this writing book that he wrote. I mean, the first 60 pages or so, which is heavy on the stuff about structure and just...
And full of graphs, those kind of graphs that to me, yeah, as soon as I'm scanning a page of prose and there's some kind of like circular graph with letters, there's a rare writer that can keep me engaged with graphs on the page, but he's managing to do it.
I mean, it's these inscrutable pictograms, right? There's like a circle and it suddenly gets populated by a dot, and then you get all these little labels going around the dots.
That say things like weasel.
Yeah, right. I mean, I have to confess, I often cannot follow the diagrams at all.
No, me either.
But I just sort of gasp at the brilliance of the mind that is able to. I've read a million writing books in my life and I've never come across anything like this. And it's amazing the degree to which he manages to bury those structures, yeah, within the books, because you're not reading it. It doesn't feel, yeah, mechanistic when you read the books. I mean, he is a very, he's a very alive American writer. I think he really is one of our great, great American writers, and he's really in a tradition with people like Mark Twain and Henry James and people who just capture life and put it on the page. And so you don't realize that you are winding through these Byzantine structures as you're reading.
No.
But they're there, and that's how he... That's how he kind of channels, I think, the because, you know, he's not a fiction writer. He doesn't sit down and invent. He sits down with mountains of gathered data, and he has to find a way to convert that into literature. And this is the way that he does it. I mean, I talked to Mark Singer at The New Yorker, and I asked him, do you ever draw a structure like this? And I remember him just like shooting me this look and saying, fuck no. Like, why would I do that? People don't do that. McPhee does that. In terms of like actionable writing strategies, it's funny. My original opening for the piece I stole from his writing book. I was so crippled by sort of, my reverence for John McPhee in writing this piece and just the anxiety of influence I was feeling, that I took one of his strategies from the book that he tells his students, which is, if you are stuck and you will be stuck, then write a letter to your mother. Just write, dear mother, and start telling her about your anxiety, your paralysis, and then start telling her, you know, what you're stuck about and why you can't write about it. So I wrote this letter to my mother about not being able to write about John McPhee. And sure enough, in paragraph 3, I started saying, oh, you know, the New Yorker magazine, right? Like that thing that's always stacked on my coffee table. And well, it's had all these great writers. And this one, John McPhee, is a particularly great one and completely unique. And here's why. And before I knew it, I found myself kind of writing the meat of the exposition that I ended up using in my piece. So it does have some good, useful advice.
Did you send the letter to your mother?
No. My editor.
Or to John McPhee.
Sam, one thing I would say about McPhee is that there's a daunting lot of his work if one wants to break into it. Any advice for our listeners where to start, which book you might pick first, what collection of shorter things, or a book about a single subject, or both? Give me two, mm-hmm, or three titles.
Okay. I would recommend, and maybe you could put a link to this on the show page. I think it's online. There's a great essay from either the late 60s or the early 70s that I have just worshipped forever, which is called In Search of Marvin Gardens. And have any of you guys read this?
No.
No.
Oh my God. It's so brilliant. It's this piece that he wrote about Monopoly, the board game.
Oh, fuck.
It's one of the more experimental things he ever wrote, and it reads like a Donald Barthelme story or something. So he has this kind of double motion. He's writing about this sort of best of seven world championship tournament of Monopoly, where he is facing off with this shadowy, brilliant opponent, and they're playing these rapid-fire Monopoly games one after another, and they're going around the board, and they're building hotels and landing on all these properties. And then he jumps to actual reportage that he has done from modern Atlantic City, which is what Monopoly is based on. Monopoly is based on this kind of like golden era Atlantic City of tycoons and wealth. And he is going to Atlantic City in the late 60s, early 70s, which as of course, all that old tycoon wealth has fled. It's a place whose infrastructure is completely falling apart, a place of crushing poverty. And he is reporting on all of the properties that he is landing on in this fake tournament that he's made up and what they actually look like in the real world at this point. And he does it all the way around the board, and he can't find Marvin Gardens. And then finally at the end, he finds Marvin Gardens, and it's this sort of great, strange reveal that I won't spoil. But it's such a brilliant little tour de force of an essay that ran in The New Yorker at some point. So I think that's online. So In Search of Marvin Gardens is one that I would absolutely start with. And it gives you a sense of the ambition and the literary chops that this guy has, the creativity that this guy has, because people often think of him as boring, and he's actually, well, he can be occasionally, but that's really not the signature of his work. So In Search of Marvin Gardens is where I would start for something short. And then in terms of books, I'd recommend The Pine Barrens, which is like a little novella about this strange region in New Jersey that I write about in the piece. And then I would also recommend a longer book that I think may be my favorite of his, called Encounters with the Archdruid, which has a very elegant, simple structure that he just pulls off so beautifully. So that's where I'd start.
Encounters with the Archdruid is the first McPhee I ever read and caused me to fall in love with both him and probably journalism.
Yeah, I think it's a perfect book. I heard that from some other people. I talked to the writer Anne Fadiman, and that was the one, or she read that book as a college student, and it was just like a bolt of lightning hit her and turned her into a writer.
I would add A Sense of Where You Are, which is the book about Bill Bradley as a Princeton undergraduate and sort of the perfect both gentleman and basketball player. It's one of the best sports books ever written. I mean, one could go on and on, but those three are wonderful, Sam.
And features one of my favorite reporting moves of all time, which is Bill Bradley was renowned for his passing ability. He's a brilliant scorer, could have scored, 80 points a game if he wanted to, but he insisted on passing constantly to his teammates, and he saw these angles that no one else could see, and people said he had eyes in the back of his head. And McPhee, who would have been in his early 30s, I think, at the time, took Bill Bradley to an optometrist to get a full eye workup to see if there was something special about his vision, and there was. He could see like 15% further with his peripheral vision than a normal human being, and he could see like 40% further up on the vertical and down below him than a normal human could looking straight ahead. It was amazing.
That's incredible. All right. Well, Sam, the piece is Mind of John McPhee. People should acquaint themselves with John McPhee, but also with Sam Anderson. It's always a pleasure. You're a GFOP. Thanks for coming back on the show.
Thank you very much, guys.
All right. Well, now is the moment in our podcast where we endorse Dana. What do you have?
Steve, my endorsement this week is slightly self-promotional, but only slightly. I'm only a small part of this very interesting project that's launching today, which is a podcast about Buster Keaton called Talking Buster Keaton. It's launching this week because this is the week of his birthday. He was born October 4th. And this is going to be a limited edition podcast, but there are going to be at least two seasons of it. I believe it's going to go through all of his silent films one by one and talk with different people, experts, and some people who knew him as well. So the first episode has just launched this week. It's an interview with his granddaughter, Melissa Talmadge Keaton, who's also become somewhat of a keeper of his reputation, a really interesting person to talk to about him. And they're going to talk about his very first film, which was made 100 years ago in 1917, called The Butcher Boy. And at some point later on down the line, I'm not sure when, but I appear in two episodes of the first season, one talking about his childhood and one talking about the movie The High Sign, which ended up being the inspiration for a blog I wrote long ago that launched my writing career and is now my Twitter handle. So I guess that's why they chose me for The High Sign. But other season one guests on Talking Buster Keaton will include Leonard Maltin, who's a huge lifelong fan and actually met Buster Keaton in his youth, and Janine Bassinger, a great film historian who's written a lot of amazing stuff about early Hollywood and silent film. and Teller, the quiet half of the Penn and Teller comedy duo, who, as you can imagine, a stage magician might be, is a huge Keaton fan. So if you want to hear what Teller's voice sounds like, you can listen. So it's called Talking Buster Keaton. The two hosts, Alec Lev and Jeremy Guskin, are wonderful interviewers and very lively, intelligent guys. They were great to talk to. And it is launching on iTunes as of today. So subscribe and give it a try.
Oh, awesome. Julia, what do you have?
I have a follow-up from our Tom Petty segment. It was very fascinating and fun to dive into the world of YouTube posts of Tom Petty videos from the late 80s and early 90s. I was one of those kids who never had MTV, so I didn't see music videos much then. It's not a form that I have etched in the inside of my eyeballs the way a lot of people of my generation do. I didn't really know what Tom Petty videos were like. That's not how I knew him. They are so weird, these videos. The production values look so hokey and down home, and just the conceits are kind of square and goofy and weird. But one video I would commend you to go watch is the video for Into the Great Wide Open, which stars Johnny Depp as the protagonist, and his ascendant career is engineered by a fairy godmother manager played by Faye Dunaway. And I just, that's like all you need to know. Like, Johnny Depp and Faye Dunaway are like running around this completely gimcrack, like badly produced video scape of that song. Anyway, there's plenty, there's a lot of goofy, fascinating videos you could watch. Certainly the video for Don't Come Around Here No More is like disturbing and psychedelic and bananas. It has an Alice in Wonderland theme. But the video for Into the Great Wide Open is just a portrait of a very different cultural moment than the one we currently inhabit. And I recommend watching it.
Mm. Yeah, some of those old Tom Petty videos, man, they are so trippy. All right, well, you know, how many jazz organists can you name? If you can name one, you can probably name Jimmy Smith, he of the Chicken Shack Boogie fame. I'm now going to give you a second. I just discovered someone named Richard Groove Holmes, who made a bunch of freaking awesome bop and soul records, jazz records. Groovin' with Jug in 1961, After Hours in 1962 are both frickin' classics. These are great, great records. Highly recommended. And then a totally bizarre one. A friend of mine out in San Francisco who's never had a glass of beer in his life has opened a micro bar at 2175 Market at Market and 15th Andy. He's going to be there for 2 weeks and then he's going to quit. But you should go. You got to check it out. It's the cutest little tiny bar, pop-up bar. And it's just a total lark on his part. It's got weird little Grand Prix posters. And if you show up and get a cheap beer, he says it's the cheapest beer in San Francisco. If you show up and say that you know me, you might get a slight discount on the beer. But he's also, I'm willing to offer that Andy will call me and you get to ask me anything. But this is not, he doesn't make a dime and nor do I off of any of this. It's this weird larky thing he did for a bunch of people who he now just wants to rid himself of. So for 2 weeks, he wants to pack the place as much as possible, which he seems to have done already. But he sent me photos of it. It's just the weirdest, littlest bar you'll ever go to. And just go get a cheap beer and Andy will call me and we'll shoot the shit. You have 2 weeks to do this, or maybe one. Time is running out, but go visit my friend Andy. He's he could use the company. All right. Is that the weirdest endorsement ever?
It adheres to the pizza in a lockbox tradition.
I do love an endorsement that is constrained not just in space, but also in time. Like, that's adding a new level, I think.
There will be a beautiful flash of lightning exactly 12:33 a.m. in Nebraska. Don't miss it.
don't miss it. 2175 Market Street. It's called Myriad, and the little bar is in back. Andy's. Go say hi to Andy.
All right.
You got to trust me on this one, people.
This is your chance to harass Steve, everybody. Enjoy.
Thank you. Thank you, Julia.
Thanks, Steve.
Thanks, Dana.
Thanks, Steven.
You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today at our show page, slate.com/culturefest. You can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note at our Facebook page, facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our intern is Daniel Schrader. Andy Bowers, chief content officer of the Panoply Network. Culture Gapfest, part of the network. Check out a roster of great shows at panoply.fm. Our Twitter feed is @SlateCultFest. For Julia Turner and Dana Stevens, I'm Stephen Metcalf. We'll see you soon. We'll